Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for March the 24th, 2019. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, Dave, I thought about turning the show over to you so you could list all of the road closings today for the Shamrock Shuffle. Oh, it's going to be one of those days here in downtown Chicago.
Getting underway. Well, actually, it's going it already is one of those days.
It is.
And that began earlier in the week, really, Thursday into Friday. They started closing off some of the streets as the setup continued along Columbus for this. But yesterday, Balbo, Jackson, all closed between Michigan and Lakeshore Drive as they get this ready for our Shamrock Shuffle.
I wasn't paying attention, and so yesterday when I was coming in to kind of do some prep work coming into downtown, and State Street was just jammed, now I know why.
That's why, yep. Oh, not only that, as the day went on yesterday, Roosevelt, which of course is a big east-west thoroughfare,
which is always crowded.
Wow. Yeah, but this was super crowded, as it was last weekend after the parade. So you had all kinds of traffic because that is the closest intersection or thoroughfare that is open south of all the activity going on Columbus.
Right.
So everybody's taking Roosevelt east and west to get to and from Lakeshore Drive.
I'm beginning to think St. Patrick's Day is like the longest holiday ever in Chicago.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
So we end with the last vestiges of that with the Shamrock Shuffle today.
Yes, as we celebrate Christmas and the holidays earlier and earlier, so we will celebrate St. Patrick's Day early. It'll begin around Valentine's.
Right, the never-ending holiday, right? Oh, wow. Well, and spring is officially
sprung.
Yes.
Happy spring. We'll have a taste of it later in the week, hitting 60 on Thursday. Temperatures maybe a bit around normal, 30, 40. Colder for tomorrow, though.
Colder tomorrow, I think colder Tuesday, too.
Yes.
And then we kind of pop into the good start of spring, hopefully.
Right.
Although, at one point yesterday, my trusty weather app on my iPhone showed snowflakes next weekend. Now, it's not showing it now, but it was like, are you kidding me?
Well, Tom Skilling's forecast is calling for temperatures only in the 30s on Saturday.
Yeah.
On the 30th.
So there you go.
Well, we've had snow in April.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Yes.
We've had snow in May.
Yes, we have.
We've had snow to start opening day.
Yes, we have.
Oh, yes.
I remember that.
1982, it was snowed out at Wrigley.
All these cheery, good Sunday mornings start your week, right?
That's why they call me Sunshine Schwanny.
Yeah, among other things.
Nice to have Andy back.
It is.
Good to be back.
And you could have brought some of that Arizona weather with you.
Oh, yeah. He was telling us how it was 75 and 80.
Yeah.
And 85.
I brought the warm weather to Arizona, and then I left
Thursday. You left it behind.
And actually, it got cooler in Arizona, so I figured it was following me, but apparently it is not. I did what I could.
So what do we need to look for as a result of your trip to Arizona? Who do we got to keep an eye on?
Now you got to keep an eye on Eloy Jimenez. I mean,
no kidding.
The Sox signing him to that deal, which pretty much clears the way for him to be on the opening day roster, which I know a lot of White Sox fans were hoping for. And, you know, the White Sox were probably planning on bringing him up sometime in April. But now you can start him on the roster at the very beginning of the year. He hit a home run yesterday. It was 3-for-3. Yoan Moncada had a nice game yesterday as well. I know it's only spring, but you look for these kind of signs from some of these younger players that you think are going to be the ones to carry you to the next level.
Decent contract signing.
Yeah, not bad for a guy that's never taken a swing in a major league game.
No kidding. Wow. I can't even remember the amount. It was just kind of stunned me.
Yeah, it was. Let me get the details here because it was kind of up and down with the fact that it's a 6-year contract
and it's backloaded.
Yeah, it's a $43 million contract, and he's going to get a $5 million bonus
signing bonus.
Yep, and then it goes to $16 million up in 2025 and $18.5 million in 2026, and they have some buyouts along the way and a couple of club options as well. So. Theoretically, they could have his rights for 8 years with those two options at the end. And, you know, basically what it does is it buys out the arbitration years, and it also buys out the fact that the service time issue that was going to get in the way this year.
Right. Kind of looking forward to baseball. Really,
yeah,
am.
Me too. I'm going to get my first taste of pregame today as well. We're going to do a pre and a postgame today for White Sox and the Indians in Glendale, and I'll be along. I'll still be here. I'll just put a different hat on starting at 1:30, and then we'll have the game for you. I'll have post game, and then we have Blackhawks.
Well, a different voice on, right?
Yeah, different hat, different voice, yeah, different name,
baseball
maybe.
Voice.
Yeah,
there
maybe
you go.
A different name.
There, yes. Well, I'll work on a name for you during the next break.
Appreciate it.
Of course, NCAA tournament action going on and some big games today.
Yeah, we've got a lot of big games basically all day now because we only had one buzzer beater so far, and that was yesterday.
That was an exciting game, yeah. LSU over Maryland.
Right.
And a true buzzer beater, too.
Yeah, 1.6 seconds left, and Maryland no timeouts. Had to heave one from half court in desperation, and that didn't work. Early game today has Tennessee against Iowa. Right after that, it'll be North Carolina taking on Washington, and Houston and Ohio State today, Virginia, Oklahoma, Oregon, UC Irvine. How about the Anteaters? They advanced. Love the name.
Yes.
Duke will be in action today against UCF, and Virginia Tech also taking on Liberty, and third-seeded Texas Tech, and number 6, Buffalo. Watch out for Buffalo.
I've heard that. Somebody else was suggesting Liberty might be the Cinderella team.
They're trying to be the Loyola of the tournament this year. But, you know, I know Buffalo's sixth seed. The only reason I say I love the Buffalo team is because Jim Weitzel, who used to coach Loyola, is an assistant coach on that staff.
Oh, very good.
So a little personal note on that.
And I think truly this early game, watch Iowa.
Yeah, you know, it was a Big Ten tournament early. I mean, it seemed like it was the Big Ten tournament. And Wisconsin bowed out, and then Minnesota had bowed out yesterday, but it was a game between two Big Ten teams, so something had to give. You know, Iowa with a 10 seed could be dangerous. Tennessee, though, is playing really, really well.
Yeah, I know.
I think they're very upset about the fact that Loyola knocked them out last year.
Best time of the year for college basketball, always. And I say that, and I don't really follow college basketball during the season, but there's something about these one and done. You know, if you don't make it, it's over. It just adds to the excitement of it.
Yeah, and it always seems like there is that one team that just kind of comes out of nowhere. You don't know anything about them, and by the end of the tournament, you're either really sick of hearing about them, or you're winning a lot of money because of them, or maybe both of the above.
So we've got that going on.
Yeah.
Yesterday afternoon loss by the Blackhawks to Colorado, which put Colorado into the second spot right now in the wild card. So 6 points in 8 games.
Well, a chance to make up 2 tonight because it's a rematch with Colorado tonight. An earlier start, normally it's a 7:30 start. Tonight it'll be 7. Chris has the pregame at 6:30 tonight, but... You know, lately, you wonder now if the climb back into that playoff chase kind of sapped a little energy out of this club. A lot of emotion, a lot of energy being expended to try to get back into it.
Especially when you're at every game being a must-win kind of situation.
Well, it's been playoff games for the Blackhawks for the last month and a half.
Right.
I mean, they've had to win a lot of games to get back to... where they are now. I mean, it's fluctuated between, I mean, there was about a 45-minute period a couple of weeks ago that they were the second wild card.
Right.
And then they were 9 points out, and then they were 4 points out, and now they're 6. But as you point out, I mean, the days are coming off the calendar. That's the real enemy right now is is the schedule with only 8 games to play, including tonight.
2 weeks left in the regular season.
How about that?
It's if only we could have another month, you know?
Yeah, another month. I tell you what, though, it does kind of bode well. And I know seasons don't carry over typically, right. But I think now that Jeremy Colleton will have a full offseason, and I'm by no means am I writing them off this year. I still think that they have a chance until they have that big E next to their name that says eliminated.
Right.
I'm going to obviously hope that they get there, being a fan and all, and wanting the games to be here on the radio as well. But, you know, I think this will bode well in this offseason, where Coach Colleton will now have a full offseason, a full training camp, and a full start to the season with these guys. And I think they've responded pretty well to him.
Well, I mean, look at the second half.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't complain too much about the second half, although we got to fix that penalty.
Yeah.
The power play,
the penalty kill, yeah. Defense in general, I think will be very high atop the shopping list of Stan Bowman in the offseason. Unfortunately, you know, the two best defenders that have been around for so long have been around for so long.
That's, and, yes.
Yeah, have skated a lot of minutes for this Blackhawks team over the last few years, and that's, of course, Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook. You know, you're seeing glimpses from Gustafson every once in a while, from Forsling every once in a while, from Dahlstrom every once in a while. Connor Murphy's been pretty solid and pretty stable, but, you know, other than that, it's been kind of like a mix and match, roll the dice kind of thing for that day. So I think that'll be pretty high on the shopping list.
Yeah, I mean, at least thank goodness Corey's back in goal, because that's been our best defense, really.
Yeah, I mean, it easily could have been 6-1 at certain points yesterday. But and you know, Duncan Keith made a great save too.
Yes, that's true.
Yesterday as well. So, yeah, it's great to see Crawford back. And, you know, now Delia will have some time to play, and Rockford will likely be the backup next year. So a lot of things can happen, obviously, in the offseason. But again, I don't write them off yet, because that E has not been flashed in front of the Blackhawks name for eliminated.
I agree. Absolutely. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, has the latest sports. Producer Cassera is in and fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is going to fetch the coffee. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead on the show, after the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Chicago mayoral contender Lori Lightfoot. She's, of course, facing Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. And we'll talk to Ms. Lightfoot about her campaign and attempts to reach a citywide audience, as well as her proposals for the city. At the top of the hour, we'll get the latest from Dave and Andy, and then we'll speak to State Senator Michael Hastings, a Democrat from Tinley Park. He's the chairman of the powerful State Senate Executive Committee. We'll speak to him about his efforts to increase the availability of mental health services, as well as a measure aimed at taking away the FOID card, those firearm owner identification cards, of those who've been previously convicted of crimes. That's an outgrowth of that deadly workplace shooting in Aurora. We'll get a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to State Representative Tom Demmer of Dixon. He's the Deputy House Republican Leader. We'll talk to him about the House GOP's opposition to Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's proposal for a graduated income tax to replace the state's constitutionally mandated flat tax.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in studio this morning is Lori Lightfoot, candidate for mayor of Chicago. Lori, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This is, what, your seventh stop already this morning, right?
Something like it. I'll be going till I drop tonight after midnight.
Maybe the previous six stops were at various Dunkin' Donuts or getting coffee or something to stay charged. But seriously, I know it's busy time. Thank you so much. We're just days away from the April 2nd runoff. I wanted to take you back to the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You have talked about, you know, you jumped in.
Right.
While Rahm was still, hadn't made up his mind, you jumped in. What was the moment that told you you should run for mayor of Chicago? What was the moment?
Well, there wasn't one moment. It was a series of things that happened over a long time that didn't start with me thinking I should run. It really started with me thinking things are not right in our city. And that really started in 2016. The task force work was done, but it was happening at a time when the violence in 16 was just really spiraling out of control. I remember thinking at the end of August of that year that, my God, we may hit 500 homicides. And what ended up happening is we almost hit 800. And just thinking about, is our city coming unglued? What's happening at this moment? And then recognizing in a pretty profound way the intense disparities that existed in neighborhoods across the city with unemployment, people, kids growing up in poverty, really the lack of resources and investment. So that kind of evolved in my thinking over a year plus. And it was really recognizing that there really was no plan to try to address these big systemic issues that were leaving people behind and neighborhoods behind. And then by then, I'm now kind of in late 2017, and people were starting to pop up and say, well, I'm going to run against Rahm, and I'm going to run against Rahm. And I watched very carefully and to not only who, but what they were saying and what their vision for the city was. And it just came to me that I didn't see anybody on the landscape that I could really rally behind, that I thought had a real vision for addressing the kind of things that I knew were necessary. It was a given for me that Rahm could not get a third term.
Right. He couldn't be reelected.
Yeah, but it was really late in 17, early 18, that I started thinking, okay, you have this tiny platform. You have a lot of resources. What are you going to do about this? And that's really what led me to thinking that I would run.
So let's talk about violence.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, with your work with the task force and before that, it's not a one quick, easy answer.
No,
here.
It's not.
And of course, economic development of the impoverished neighborhoods is a key factor.
Yep.
I mean, but to me, it's one of those where you can talk about we need to do this, but how do you really bring some of that investment and small businesses, mm-hmm, and employment? How do you actually make that happen?
Well, we know how to do that. We're downtown in a beautiful area. We've seen the incredible development in the West Loop, the South Loop, and River North. And that's because we had a mayor or mayors who really focused on those regions of the city, used the city's resources, whether it's TIF dollars or otherwise, and then brought private investment into these neighborhoods. So we know how to do this if we make an area a priority, how to really use the full force of city resources, private investment, philanthropic dollars to really spur small business development. We know how to do it. And let me give you just some specific concretes on small businesses. The city procures goods and services of about $2 billion every year. We could use that buying power to break down some of these contracts into smaller bites so that small businesses could get them on their own without having to go to, say, Mother May I to a prime. The city obviously has to pay those people in a timely fashion. The mayor should use the bully pulpit of the mayor's office to go to banks and other financial lenders to encourage them and cajole them if necessary to lower the barriers to access to capital. In the city itself, we have a lot of different funds that we use to try to spur economic development. Let's turn those into real grant programs, not matching grants. Let's develop a really robust microfinancing. And what we should also be doing is creating incubator spaces, not on necessarily the scale of 1871, but incubator spaces in our neighborhoods so we can develop that peer-to-peer conversation, mentorship, bring professionals in like lawyers, accountants, marketing experts, so that businesses have one-stop shopping that they can go to try to get support for their ideas or to shore up their existing businesses. So I think there's a lot of things right now today that the city could do if it had that focus. The problem is that we've not had a comprehensive economic development plan in years, and certainly not in the last 7 years. So that's why we see so many neighborhoods south of Roosevelt Road or west of Ashland struggling and starving, because the city's not focused on them.
I mean, you cite the lack of a strategic plan. You've talked regularly about the lack of a risk management.
Yep.
And here we see another payout going out the door, and the millions of dollars that the city pays out.
$113 million last year alone on police settlements, judgments, and attorney's fees. $28 million to lawyers in defense of the city. There's something horribly wrong with that.
But it's just seems like it's treated as business as usual.
Yes, unfortunately, it has been, but it won't be if I'm elected mayor.
What else in that category, like you say, strategic planning, risk management, what else are we lacking that we don't know that we're lacking?
Well, we have a lot of really redundant processes in city government. I'll give you a perfect example. We have a clerk's office that has a set up its own financial apparatus, its own administrative, HR, to dole out very modest clerical responsibilities. Do we really need a separate clerk's office with all those separate functions and that huge budget to handle city stickers, to handle the city key system and collect bills? I don't think so. And we think about the treasurer's office. Do we really need a whole separate treasurer's office to perform things that could easily be done by the financial experts within the executive branch? Those are just a couple examples. One
make
last
them appointed.
No, I think you get rid of them. They were there by Richard Day Daley to make sure that blacks and Hispanics had a citywide office so they wouldn't challenge him for mayor. But in this time of real financial crises in our city, we have to think hard about these redundant functions. Why do we have a separate county board of elections and a separate city board of elections that essentially perform the same function? And there's been study after study, the efficiencies that could be had to consolidate those functions. So I just think we have to take a critical eye to every aspect of city government and not just assume, well, this huge behemoth is what it is, and we just need to keep collecting your tax dollars to keep feeding it. I think we have to take a very different mindset into city government in light of the fact that a lot of taxpayers not only feel like they're nickel and dime, that they feel like because we're not managing their fiscal dollars, their tax dollars effectively, that we're collecting them and just lighting them on fire. And we got to change that mindset.
We're speaking with Lori Lightfoot, attorney, candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in studio is Lori Lightfoot, candidate for mayor of Chicago. With all of these debates and everything, and I know the answers are almost rote right now, but I did want to ask, you've talked about having a serious discussion about revenue,
mm-hmm.
okay, without getting into real specifics,
mm-hmm.
but you've also talked about progressive revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of curious because you've ruled out a sales tax, a LaSalle Street tax.
No soda tax.
No soda tax. You've ruled out a city income tax. A commuter tax you've ruled out. You're against a pension obligation bond. But when you say progressive revenue, what are you talking about?
What that means is that we don't balance the budget on the backs of the people who are least able to handle it. We were talking during the break about some of the things that have happened. For example, the ticketing process. I mean, we've seen study after study that shows that disproportionately black and brown communities are really shouldering the burden of the ticketing process, whether it's red light cameras or just non-moving parking tickets. I mean, there's a study that even came out last year that showed that if you ride a bike in Chicago, if you're black, you're going to get more tickets than anybody else. I mean, that just underscores how absurd and obscene the system has gone. When I travel in neighborhoods across the city, the one issue that comes up without fail is the ticketing issue. It's not shootings. It's not schools. Now, people do talk about that, but the ticketing issue, people losing their vehicles because mm-hmm. they can't pay the tickets, and then they get sold at auction or sold for scrap. People losing their driver's license over non-moving violation tickets. And I've seen the data. It is an astronomical burden on low-income and working-class families. That's just not right or fair. So when we talk about progressive, it means making sure that people pay their fair share, but in proportion to what their income is. One of the things that I propose is a tax on high-end law firms, accounting firms, akin to like the VAT tax, the value-added tax in Europe. Not on the little guys, not on the solo practitioners or small CPA firms, but a firm like mine, which is a large international law firm, putting a small fee on the invoices that they send to their clients will barely be noticed, but yet could generate hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. So I think those are the kind of things that we need to think about.
I was wondering, too, what about not a total overall sales tax increase, but something like a service tax on some high-end services?
Well, we have to look at that, but service taxes can also, depending on how they're drafted, they can also be regressive. I want to free up our people that are struggling every single day, like families like mine. People are leaving the city, and if you look at who's leaving, it's not the high-end folks, because this city works for them. Who are leaving are low-income, working-class families who have mobility. We're gutting our middle class in the city. And I hear from people who are former city workers, people living on pensions, are the true middle class that's left in our city, they need some tax relief. And I understand that.
Yesterday in Bronzeville, your opponent had a rally, which there were some pretty incendiary remarks made by Bobby Rush. And I'm not going to get into those, but I just see it as a kind of a very bizarre kind of thing of trying to, here we have this historic contest of two African-American women who's going to be mayor of Chicago, and yet it's racial politics.
Mm-hmm. Sadly.
And, you know, you're a North Sider. You can't, I mean, it's these, I mean, which, I mean, I'm just curious, when people bring up these kind of things, how do you respond?
Well, look, I think what we saw on display yesterday was a campaign that is failing, it's running out of money, probably not going to be back up on TV, that developed the strategy from election night on February 26th, that the only path to Tony Preckwinkle's victory is to denigrate and try to destroy me and make me into something other than what I am and obliterate the life that I've lived, the public service that I've given. Look, I am disturbed and disappointed that people who claim to be public servants would resort to that kind of low-grade, race-baiting hatred. We can't tolerate that in our city. We get a daily deluge of that kind of thing from Trump, and we've seen it. Fear and hate used to stir up and whip up a frenzy, but really to divide us. In this time, in 2019, we need to be thinking about how we bring people together. We're going to have a lot of tough challenges to face as a city, no matter the outcome in the election. And what we need is a leader who stands for unity, who stands for looking at the beautiful diversity of our city and thinking about how we can bridge divides, not create them and expand them. That's what we saw yesterday, was racial hatred, division, toxicity. We don't need that in our city. It's not leadership. How are you going to be a cheerleader for this great city and you foment that kind of hate? How are you going to be a global leader to encourage businesses to come here from all across the world, people who are of different races and ethnicities, to feel comfortable when you stand and let that kind of nasty, horrible, racist, fear-mongering be propagated on your behalf and in your name? I don't see that as consistent with leadership and a kind of vision that we have to have for our city.
One last question. Obviously, your opponent is campaigning on experience and, and in essence, you know, saying you lack experience. Quickly, how do you answer that
I'd love to talk about her experience of raising taxes, going back on her word about the sales tax, trying to shove down the throats of people a soda tax, and the people that she surrounds herself. Yesterday was part of it, but let's talk about her experience with Ed Burke and with Joe Berrios, who crushed the dreams of low-income black and brown homeowners with a horrible regressive property tax assessment system. Those are the experiences of her life on full display. The fact that she's embraced Ed Burke, gave his kid a job without doing any vetting, $100,000 a year job just because of who his father was. I'm happy to talk about her experience.
But what about your experience?
Well, I think my experience is one of dedicated public service, taking on tough challenges, whether it was at the police department, the city's 911 center, the city's procurement department, where I did a lot to make sure that small businesses got a fair shake in city contracting, or taking on some of the toughest issues of our time with police reform and accountability, where other people shied away. I have never shied away from taking on a tough challenge, speaking truth to power. And the toughest of challenges is putting myself out there as a candidate for mayor when Rahm Emanuel was still very much in the thick and running. I didn't stand on the sidelines, fearfully waiting, hoping that something would break so that I could use the politically expedient path to power. I stepped up, presented myself to the voters when Rahm was still on the ballot. I wasn't afraid of him like Tony Preckwinkle.
That's Lori Lightfoot, candidate for mayor of Chicago. Lori, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Obviously, as Dave mentioned in the news, Washington kind of waiting with the announcement that late Friday afternoon that special counsel Robert Mueller had submitted his nearly two-year investigation into President Trump and Russia, a comprehensive report submitted to the Attorney General William Barr, expecting the possibility of being able to report on the principal conclusions that were found in the report later today. Democratic leaders are asking for transparency, and also they don't want the White House to get a heads up on the report before they do. Here's Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
Now that Special Counsel Mueller has submitted his report to the Attorney General, it's imperative for Mr. Barr to make the full report public and provide its underlying documentation and findings to Congress. Attorney General Barr must not give President Trump, his lawyers, or his staff any sneak preview of Special Counsel Mueller's findings or evidence. And the White House must not be allowed to interfere in decisions about what parts of those findings or evidence should be made public.
That's Chuck Schumer. We're going to bring things back home to Illinois here and talk about what's going on down in Springfield. And joining me now on the phone is Mike Hastings, Democratic State Senator from Tinley Park, who's chairman of the powerful Senate Executive Committee in Springfield. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, Rick. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm well. Thank you so much. I wanted to ask you about the FOID card legislation, cracking down on illegal gun possession. Obviously, something spurred by the fact that that tragic workplace shooting in Aurora, that the killer was able to obtain a gun despite having a previous felony conviction. Can you tell us what this legislation does? And I mean, this seems like recovering FOID cards from people who shouldn't have them has been a long-time problem in this state.
Well, Rick, first, the primary purpose of the bill is to fix the reporting to the National Criminal Background Check system. And so, obviously, like any other system, garbage in equals garbage out. And it's important that people report crimes, especially felonies, whether they be at the local level all the way up to the Illinois State Police. And the reason for that is, you know, obviously in the Aurora situation, we missed the felony that was committed in Mississippi from the gentleman who did the shooting in Aurora. So the primary thing is to fix the background system, the background check system. And then from there, you know, when somebody does a background check for a FOID card, then you'll have that information. And then the second part of it is obviously what happens to the person's FOID card. And obviously we're working with the state police on various mechanisms that they feel as if there's flaws. And then we're also talking about other things, whether that be an electronic FOID card or an electronic conceal and carry license. So that's some things that are currently in negotiation right now.
So by virtue of having an electronic one, that way it can be deactivated instantly rather than having to go through the process of trying to recover a physical identification card.
That's correct. And obviously these things are still being discussed as options that are out there. So especially when you confiscate someone's FOID card as well, this is a very sensitive topic because people's Second Amendment rights, people take that very seriously. And I've seen that through thousands of letters that I've received into my office just for trying to fix the background check system. But, you know, one of the components that some advocates were pushing was the confiscation of firearms after the FOID card has been revoked. And that's a very sensitive topic that I'm keenly sensitive to myself because I don't want to put law enforcement officials at risk. And I know when you go and confiscate somebody's firearm, they actually have a firearm. And sometimes people aren't so willing to relinquish their weapons. But, again, my goal is to fix the background check system and then work with the state police and trying to figure out a common sense way to fixing this problem.
Well, and I mean, obviously there would be some kind of due process element here.
Yes, there's obviously court cases that have been given. I believe Henderson versus U.S. is one of them, which kind of talks about the constitutional process of removing someone's firearms. But we're trying to do this in a way where it's, you know, number one, it's safe. Number two, it fixes the problem. I think reporting firearms should not be in the hands of bad people. I think Republicans and Democrats alike can both get behind this notion. And I'll say this. When I do these negotiations with the Republicans, they're very open to this. And we're trying to accommodate everybody in this process because I know how sensitive this subject is.
The Second Amendment is a very sensitive topic in Springfield, as we all know. We're speaking with Mike Hastings, Democratic State Senator from Tinley Park, Chairman of the Senate Executive Committee in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline Studio overlooking the Chicago River. Joining me on the phone is Michael Hastings, Democratic State Senator from Tinley Park. He's also chairman of the State Senate Executive Committee. Senator, I want to shift gears a little bit, too. I know you've been active as part of a group of Democratic senators who are looking to increase access to mental health treatment across the state. And I think, you know, obviously with Chicago and issues of closing mental health centers, the fact that in Cook County, as Sheriff Dart says, Cook County Jail is the largest mental health treatment center in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about the legislation that you're looking at?
So we created the March to Mental Health, and obviously March is normally known for basketball, but I wanted to make March known for something else, and I know we have all these awareness months. So me and a team of about five senators got together and said, what are some things we can do to help move the ball down the field in terms of fixing mental illness and mental health treatment? So there's a few bills that are out there I think are really important. One, which I think is a key touchstone, especially for the prison population and the general population, is Senate Bill 1715. And what it allows for is pharmacists to be able to administer medicine to patients through the form of injectables. So injectable medicine these days has a duration of 60 days, and it'll provide mental health stability for 60 days. So a lot of people who have mental illnesses forget to take their medicine, especially those that are leaving the prison population. So before they leave a prison population, they can get their last dosage of mental health medicine. It could be administered to them, and then it provides them stability. So when you're leaving the prison population, you know, when you're looking for a house, you're looking for a job, you know, you don't have to worry about, I mean, I got to get my prescription, I got to take my medicine. And that's going to be a very important thing.
I know. I mean, where does that bill stand right now?
It's actually on, it's agreed upon in the Senate. So all the stakeholders have agreed on it through negotiations. The psychiatrist, the psychologist, the pharmacist, the state medical society, all the key stakeholders, we brought them all in a room. We explained to them the problem about people not having stability once they leave, whether it's the prison population or just people in general who have a hard time taking medicine. Rick, you and I both know that when somebody goes off their meds, bad things happen. And in order to provide long-term treatment, that's important. Now, these things are expensive drugs, don't get me wrong. We've also provided for other laws to where, whether you're like a managed care organization or on Medicaid, these bills should be carved out and allowed for. Normally, there's like a maximum prescription limit you can have, but it's important. People with mental illness and people with mental health issues need stability, and stability provides a lot of benefits to the community.
I want to talk about some of the most, I guess, most talked about issues in Springfield. Obviously,
Sure. We
have Governor Pritzker now has rolled out those proposed rates for the proposed constitutional change to allow for a graduated rate. Income tax, and the governor says these rates are of course subject to negotiation. I don't believe that a passage of that constitutional amendment is necessarily a foregone conclusion, despite the fact Democrats have super majorities in both the House and Senate. I think it will pass the Senate, but I question whether the votes are necessarily there in the House, despite Speaker Madigan's 74 votes. It needs 71 to get on the ballot. How do you read the tea leaves on this?
I think if 97% of Illinois residents are going to get a tax break, I think 97% of Illinois residents will probably want to take that tax break. I don't know very often, Rick, where, at least in my, I haven't been in the Senate for very long, where the government actually offers people a tax reduction. So whether it's $100, $400, $1,000, the cost of doing business, whether you're in your home or whether you're in the government, tends to go up. So, in the Senate, obviously, it'll come through my committee, and we take these things very seriously, especially when it comes to a constitutional amendment. Obviously, we'll bring in experts. We'll have a discussion about it and determine what's good for Illinois. And obviously, it takes a supermajority vote. I don't speak for the Speaker, the House of Representatives.
I would never ask you to speak. I would never ask you to speak for the Speaker. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can just tell you this. I know the Speaker of the House. He's a very smart man, and he tries to do right by the people of Illinois, regardless of what the last 4 years have said. And I think that'll come to fruition here in May.
What about as far as Capitol bill? We've seen now your colleague Marty Sandoval in the Senate Transportation Committee proposing a 19 cent per gallon increase in the current 19 cent per gallon gas tax, larger vehicle fees, license plate fees as part of the basic for a transportation infrastructure bill. I mean, obviously, people on both sides talk about the need for a public works bill, but I'm still not sure that necessarily the votes are there for the ways to pay for it.
Well, I know this. My Republican state representative, and I have a bipartisan district. I have both a Republican and a Democratic state representative. She actually committed in public to voting for an infrastructure bill, which kind of gives me the temperature of the room, because normally she doesn't vote for anything. you know, there's coalitions that are out there right now that are examining, like, okay, what roads need to be done, what bridges need to be done. I think as a right now is a good starting point. I think horizontal capital is probably something that's probably the most needed here in the state. If you drive down I-80 to the Joliet Bridge, there's a flashing neon green sign that says bridges in critical condition, and I drive that to go to court at Will County, and I agree. I think that not only is it backed up there, I think the bridge has been that way probably for the past 20 years, and the last thing you want is a bridge to fall in. But, you know, when you talk to the general population, Rick, as a whole, everyone will agree that if you're going to whether it's raise money and spend money, people don't want to see it wasted. People want to see it used towards a specific item, and especially road work. I think our lockbox amendment that was passed in the previous election cycles, I think that's something where people are like, use the money for what you say it's going to be used for. And I think that's very important to do. And if it does pass, I know our roads can use a facelift. There's no doubt about that. And I think people would be supportive as long as we use that money for what it's supposed to be used for.
And it provides something tangible that people can see, which
100%. Rick, in that school funding reform bill, when I look at my district, we brought in $30 million, whether that's in terms of additional school funding or grants. The schools, it went straight to the schools. The schools spent it on the kids and their education. And the parents in the community see it. They actually see it. So although everybody hates construction, everybody hates those orange cones out there pumping a couple billion dollars into the roads to make sure you don't get a flat tire in the middle of the city of Chicago because the pothole wasn't filled or the road is so crappy that, you know, you got to get it done. I think people will be happy about that as well.
That's Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park, chairman of the State Senate Executive Committee. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, you're the best, buddy. I'm sorry I couldn't make it down, but I'll see you soon.
Well, we didn't want you dodging the runners from the Shamrock Shuffle. So thanks, Senator. We'll talk to you soon.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. You know, it seems like every day there's somebody announcing that they're running for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. But there's one person who was considering it and then decided not to seek that presidential nomination. That's former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg, of course, certainly has the resources out of his own pocket. But he said in a recent interview that he did not see a path for victory.
At some point, you've got to say, look, I would be 79 years old when I took office. People say, well, Ronald Reagan was 80 when he left. Yeah, when he was 80, they carried him out gaga. That really is very close. I don't mean to exaggerate it, but that's very close to being true. To start a four-year job, maybe an eight-year job at age 79 may not be the smartest thing to do. But I think if I thought I could win, I would have. I just couldn't see a path where I could get the nomination and to spend the next year and a half, 2 years of my life campaigning.
That's former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Well, we're going to switch gears and come back locally again and talk about a little more about Springfield, and we'll talk from the Republican perspective. Joining me now on the phone is Representative Tom Demmer. He is the House Republican leader from Dixon, Illinois. Representative, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm curious, we've seen the proposal from Governor Pritzker on the graduated rate income tax. We've seen his proposed tax rates. And the House Republicans are basically standing united saying, no, we're not interested in a graduated rate income tax. We're not interested in, does that carry over? Is there no talk, no negotiation on this?
Well, I think we have a pretty clear stand right now. We have all the members of the House Republican Caucus who've signed on to a resolution saying we don't think a graduated tax is the right direction. So, you know, we're trying to negotiate on a lot of other pressing issues right now, namely getting a balanced budget in this upcoming fiscal year, you know, working on things that will improve the state's economy. But when we look at the graduated tax, we think it's really just really opening the door to a lot of bad things down the road. And so we're opposed to it.
Well, I mean, when you say a lot of bad things down the road, what can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I think the question right now is, you know, not about one specific rate structure that's being put in place. That's the kind of conversation that the Pritzker administration wants to focus on. But what we're looking at is the question is really, should the flat tax protection be removed from the Constitution? And when we look at the track record we have in Springfield with tax increases, we think that removing a flat tax protection from the Constitution gives a blank check to lawmakers in Springfield, and that the rate schedule that we see a few years down the road is going to look nothing like this one that was initially proposed.
But, I mean, we as you said, we do, you know, it's not often, but we do raise the current flat rate income tax, and we've done it actually relatively frequently in the last couple of years.
Yeah, we have, and I think that's part of the point here is that, you know, we sort of feel like, what are we, again, coming back to the well, again, just looking at raising taxes instead of, you know, looking at some of the other things. I mean, I think, you know, last week you had Deputy Governor Hines on, and I thought one of his quotes was pretty revealing. He said that in the current fiscal year's budget, they said no to 90% of the requests for more funding. So I think we have to ask, if they're able to pass a graduated tax, are they still going to have the discipline to say no to 90% of the requests for more funding? Or is it more likely for us to believe that they're going to have to say yes to a lot of those and continue to come back to Illinois taxpayers to try to find a way to pay for it?
Well, in that conversation with Deputy Governor Hines, I was curious, too, when I asked him about, you know, as a sign of kind of purchase and goodwill about budget cuts. And he basically said, you know, we've cut everything that we can cut. And I mean, it is government. Come on. I was kind of skeptical with that answer.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, we look at the amount of time that the Pritzker administration has spent on raising taxes and, you know, designing a new rate structure for taxes. They should have spent a little bit of time of that on the other side of the ledger. The budget they introduced, I think the only two things you could say are cuts are, one, underfunding our pension contribution, which we know what kind of track record that has in Springfield, and two, eliminating a scholarship program for low-income families. And that's what they point to as cuts on that side of the ledger. We think there's probably something else there, and, you know, we're certainly willing to work with them and try to come up with a plan that spends money responsibly and tries to save money where we can.
Well, do you believe there is a need for additional revenue?
I think that we could get additional revenue if we make some changes that'll help us grow our economy. I mean, this is the message we've been talking about. As you mentioned, we've raised taxes a couple times in the last decade. At each of those times, Republicans were there saying, you can't only look at what the tax rate is. You can't just continue to hope that we're going to get more revenue by changing the rate. We've been focused on trying to enact policies that'll bring people back to the state of Illinois, reverse the population loss that we see, add new jobs here. I mean, the point was made several times in the last few years. If Illinois was growing, even at an average rate, you know, even at looking across the country at an average rate, we'd have a huge amount of revenue that'd be coming into the state. Instead, we're probably the slowest growing state in the country. We're losing people. We're not capitalizing on some of the economic success that other states have seen. And that has a direct impact on our bottom line.
You know, one of the things when you talk about kind of the exodus and everything, and I was did a conference in Aurora at Aurora University on Midwest and revival attempts in the Rust Belt, and I think of a place like, you know, Dixon along the Rock River and Dixon Sterling and that, and I'm curious, you know, what is the rural economy like in medium, small and medium, mid-sized communities in Illinois?
You know, I think you kind of see some pockets of places where they've gotten things right, and you see some development. Rochelle is right at the center of my district, you know, a town that sits at the intersection of Interstate 88 and Route 39, so a good logistical hub there. They've been able to capitalize on a lot of that geographic location and some of the advantages that come with that. Other communities, though, if you're in a rural Illinois and you don't sit on an interstate or on a major rail line, it's a struggle. And you tend to sort of go along with the health of the agriculture market, which, you know, is strong across rural Illinois. So, you know, that can be a strength in a good year. But in other years, you really need a chance to diversify. And now communities have that opportunity.
We're speaking with Tom Demmer. He is the House Republican leader from Dixon, Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone by Tom Demmer, House Republican leader from Dixon. How are you? Again,
great,
Representative.
Good.
I want to ask you about Capitol, Deputy House Republican leader. I don't want to put Durkin. I don't want to get Durkin mad at you.
Yeah, they'll give you in trouble.
Not that you haven't earned the promotion, trust me, but that we'll discuss that off the air. Representative, let's talk about Capitol, and I discussed this with Senator Hastings from Tinley Park about now there's a proposal that Senator Sandoval has proposed about doubling the gasoline tax, and along with raising license plate fees and driver's license fees, those kinds of things, to get a transportation capital bill rolling. I think there is support on both sides for a capital bill, since it's been so long since we had one. But again, that the issue comes down to how are we going to pay for this.
Yeah, it does come down to that. That's the big question all the time. I mean, you know, both sides recognize investments in capital infrastructure are a big part of making sure that we're a competitive place for economic opportunity. You know, I mentioned before the break that a lot of my area, there's a big logistics industry, right? We're in a rural area. You can build a big warehouse, but you have to have a way to get those products to market. So things that we're growing and manufacturing across Illinois, we have to be able to get them on a semi or put them on a train and bring them across the country and across the world. So it's an important investment for us to make. But the big question is, you know, I think a couple of things. One, how do we pay for it? And then, you know, two, what kind of assurances, what kind of accountability can we give to taxpayers to let them know that the dollars are going to be spent in a responsible way, in a fair way? And try to make those dollars go as far as possible. And so, you know, at the end of the day, that you have to put that package together and try to make a case to voters that it's a good thing for the state.
Well, is there a process going on right now as far as, you know, trying to do that kind of project identification?
Yeah, there's, I think, a lot of individual lawmakers are reaching out to people in their areas. I know there's a capital appropriations committee that's met in the House and heard testimony from all sorts of different agencies and associations who are talking about the projects that are important to their members. So that's kind of the first step, is to get a sense of what kind of needs are out there by both talking to, you know, to IDOT, to kind of the statewide agencies, but also talking to people at the local level. And then we got to figure out what we can afford to do, you know, what kind of investment we can afford to make.
Well, and it's not just issues of transportation either. I mean, there's a lot of deferred maintenance on public institutions, on higher education, corrections, even local schools.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we look at state facilities, you know, I've got a couple of them in my district is touring those facilities. They're in dire need of repair. You know, some buildings are not, they're not able to occupy right now because they're, you know, just not in a condition to be able to do that. So there is a lot of deferred maintenance and things that have built up over the years. That's, you know, I think also a part of that plan when we're talking about putting together a successful capital plan, we have to ask, you know, how can we make sure that we don't just end up in this situation again 10 years from now saying, you know, boy, it was nice to have that capital bill 10 years ago, but you know, all these projects have been kind of languishing since then. So continued investment in capital to try to prevent problems from getting worse, you know, intervene before the problem kind of spirals out of control. That's an important part of a long-term capital plan as well.
So like indexing the gas tax to inflation or something of that nature?
But also just scheduling your projects. You know, there's a difference, different proposals right now about, are we going to try to do a pay-as-you-go capital and make annual investments? Are we going to borrow and, you know, do more of the spending up front and then pay for that over the long term? And I think you really need to look at, you know, those sort of two sides of the coin and figure out what the appropriate balance is between making ongoing continued investments versus making maybe a big set of investments up front.
Although, I mean, we, in essence, we're doing pay-as-you-go for the last 4 years and really, you know, didn't make a lot of progress.
That's because we're pretty limited in the funds that were available. So if we're talking about doing a new capital program, we're talking about some new revenue sources dedicated to that, I think that gives you an opportunity to maybe expand that plan beyond just the sort of ongoing maintenance projects and actually do some new things year to year.
Are you opposed to a gas tax increase or just...
I think we have to be sensitive about it. But if we're able to put together a compelling plan, I think it's in the best interest of taxpayers that we have an efficient infrastructure. I mean, this is the time of year you're seeing people who say, you know, I got a flat tire because I ran through a pothole so big that, you know, it swallowed up the front half of my car. Those are the kind of things that we need to correct. And if we let some of those resources continue to deteriorate, there's a long-term cost associated with that as well. And so individuals have to, you know, sort of make that decision.
You touched on this earlier in our conversation about the issue of trying to negotiate our way through the really still the current budget year and the shortfalls that occurred there, the budget year, which ends on June 30th. Where are those negotiations? Where do those stand?
Well, we've just begun some appropriations committees in the House, having agency directors come in. We're still a little bit early in that process. But I think this is really important for us to know that, you know, regardless of what happens on the graduated tax discussion, there's no way that impacts this current fiscal year or even the upcoming fiscal year. So we have to, you know, we have to work through trying to get a balanced budget for this upcoming year without, you know, either side being able to talk about that graduated tax. That's still a problem we have to get together on. And so, you know, I look forward to sitting down and having those kind of negotiations. It's something both parties really have to be open to do, because there's not a magic bullet here.
No, and there's, as you said, there's no graduated rate. There's going to be plenty of talk about it, but the actual effects wouldn't be seen if it were to even go into effect until 2020.
At the earliest,
right.
Mean, more likely, you know, because November of 2020 when voters weigh in, and it's got to be certified and everything before we can pass. So the very tail end of 2020, maybe 2021. And so in the meantime, you know, we have to look for other solutions, and we have to be able to negotiate and work together on a balanced budget.
That's Tom Demmer. He is the Deputy House Republican Leader from Dixon, Illinois. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks a lot, Rick.